Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. The first topic today is damage the sun does to our skin.
The damage is kind of permanent. So, you know, to maybe the naked eye, the skin might look normal, but the skin's structure is permanently damaged and it cannot repair itself adequately. And if skin cannot repair itself, it then ultimately becomes much higher risk of cancer.
Dr. Amy Perkins is a consultant dermatologist and lead ambassador for the Skin Charity, and she gives some info on this and advice on how to avoid the problem. Then here's something else scary.
It accumulates all the bacteria, and this is how it gets into the food chain, even into plankton, which is a cornerstone of the marine ecosystem, and then it may come back on our plate.
Yeah, the next topic is microplastics with Alexander Nolte of Guppy Friend. He talks about the issue and what we can all do to mitigate the problem. So please do join me for a great show. Thank you. Dr. Amy Perkins is a consultant dermatologist and the lead ambassador for the Skin Charity. My first question to her was, what is the Skin Charity? Because it's not spelled S-K-I-N, it's spelled S-K-C-I-N.
Yeah, so Skin stands for S-K-C-I-N, and it was developed many years ago now. And after the unfortunate, very sad death of the mother of the founder, who died with melanoma. And since her passing, the Skin Cancer Charity have developed enormously positive contributions to the world of skin cancer prevention. And I'm really excited to talk more about that today, particularly their new program called Expose the Glow, which is aimed specifically at secondary school students.
Okay. Right. There will be lots of opportunity to talk about that for sure. But essentially, though, I kind of thought we'd all got the message. You know, too much sun is bad, slap on the factor 50 and wear a hat. Have we forgotten or what's going on?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's lots and lots of misinformation out there, and this has become a huge part of what we do at Skin. And as a consultant dermatologist, we are seeing enormous rises, unfortunately, in how much skin cancer is going around. So unfortunately, the messaging is not getting as much traction as we'd like, so we're working hard to make a difference.
Right. So what actually happens, you know, when we go out in the sun, and we either get a tan or get burnt. Why is that actually a problem? What is the damage that's caused, and why does this potentially go on to cause cancer?
Yeah, good question. So we all grow up and think, okay, a tan is healthy and a sunburn is bad, okay? But actually, any time your skin changes colour, that is your skin responding to damage from the sun. And really, this is, whenever your skin changes colour, this is it calling out for help. It's really you shouting out for protection. So I always say to people, if you're going outside, the aim is not to change colour at all. Now, when we see that colour change, what really happens is down kind of in the root of the skin. So even though if we get a sunburn, that might just last a few days, the damage goes much, much deeper. So even having a sunburn a few times in your life can really increase your risk of skin cancer many years down the line.
Okay. This isn't, it's probably an unfair question. Can you give a potted reason why?
So really, I mean, UV exposure causes it causes damage in the structure of our skin's DNA. Okay. So the more damage we get, the greater the damage, you know, persists, and the damage is just impossible to repair over time. So that's why if we get a nasty burn in childhood, the damage is kind of permanent. So, you know, to maybe the naked eye, the skin might look normal, but the skin's structure is permanently damaged and it cannot repair itself adequately. And if skin cannot repair itself, it then ultimately becomes much higher risk of cancer.
Okay, all right. Well, let's get down to it. How many people die of skin cancer in the UK?
Oh, so skin cancer is rising hugely. So about one in five people in the UK get skin cancer now. And there are many different types. The most dangerous is melanoma. And it's estimated around, I think it's around 7 people every day are passing away with skin cancer now.
All right. So melanoma is the most dangerous skin cancer. How come that's different?
So melanoma is a slightly different skin cancer. It is far more aggressive. The vast majority of skin cancers are contributed to by UV radiation. So that's obviously from the sun, from sunbeds. There are various different types. The commonest is called the BCC. That stands for basal cell carcinoma. And then we have squamous cell carcinomas and melanomas. Okay, so squamous cell carcinomas, otherwise known as SCC, and melanomas are the much more deadly ones. And melanoma is really the worst of all.
Okay, all right. There were some stats that came out with your press release, and some of them, I have to say, were a little bit scary. One that caught my eye, 34% of UK 16 to 17-year-olds report using a sunbed. So, I mean, is that really true? I found that very hard to believe.
So, yeah, this stat is really worrying. This was done in a relatively small study, so it's difficult to say with absolute certainty how concrete true it is across the nation. But we certainly know that sunbed use in young people is on the rise. And unfortunately, a big driver of that is social media. So this is something we're really trying to target hard via Exposed.
So, I mean, where are these sunbeds? Because in my town, there used to be a tanning kind of shop in the middle, but there isn't any more. I just don't see sunbeds in my normal life. Well, where are they?
Oh, they're everywhere.
Are they? Am I just walking around with my eyes shut?
You may need to be a wee bit more observant.
No, all right, fair enough.
So are
there any restrictions on them? Can anyone sort of walk into a tanning place and say, yeah, I'll have, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes under the lamps? Or are there age restrictions? Tell me, I don't know anything about the whole sunbed tanning industry.
Of course, happy to dive in. So there are various sunbed regulation acts. There is one covering Scotland, there's one for England and Wales, and there's one for Northern Ireland.
Just have one for everyone? That just seems silly, doesn't it? Anyway, sorry, carry on.
They have similar but slightly different rules. The key component covering all the devolved nations is that it is illegal for under 18-year-olds to use sunbeds. Now, the problem is this does not seem to be implemented. And even worse than that, if you're under the age of 35, even using a sunbed once increases your risk of lifelong cancer hugely. Some say up to 70% just with using a sunbed once under the age of 35. But if you're under 18, your skin is way more vulnerable to long-term damage. And it's so worrying because, you know, from personal experience, I see patients come in really regularly who are under 18 using sunbeds. So these regulations are in place, but they are not being implemented.
So the establishments where these children are going to use these sunbeds are breaking the law?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's kind of something that could be sorted out pretty quickly, I would suggest, if it was because, this is a serious public health issue, isn't it?
It's a huge public health issue. And this is very timely because actually this morning, just about 2 hours ago, the all-party parliamentary group UV reports was released. And this is a huge day. It's a very positive step forward in UV safety. And the recommendations go into lots of detail, but the key important ones is that they have recommended implementing formalised education to primary and secondary schools. So, of course, SKIN, the Skin Cancer Charity, are playing a huge role in this already. They've had really great success with SunSafe Schools, which was aimed at primary schools, and now Expose the Glow. Other important measures are that the report is recommending is, cutting VAT on sunscreen so it's more affordable for everyone to use and buy, and also really limiting stopping all advertisement of sunbeds, which I think is a really positive step forward.
So, I mean, useful things, but getting back to the fact that it's illegal for children to use these things. I mean, it's like if you compare it with smoking, shops that sell cigarettes to kids get shut down or fined. Surely we can do the same thing with the whole sunbed issue, because I've never heard of any establishment getting into trouble for letting children use sunbeds. Has it ever happened?
Yep, you're absolutely right. And the truth is, it's incredibly rare for establishments to get in trouble for allowing under 18-year-olds to get in. And there are various reasons for why that is. Number one, the majority of councils and kind of authorities in the UK do not require a sunbed salon to have a license. So that means we actually have no way of knowing exactly how many sunbed shops there are in the UK. So say, for example, you're in a council. There may well be, 500 sunbed shops in your jurisdiction, but you don't know that. So therefore, it's very hard to make spot checks. Yeah. Some councils
Well, actually,
can,
it's more than very hard. It's impossible, actually, really, isn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah. And so, well, not impossible. Some environmental health officers I know do make spot checks. And even when they are making spot checks, they're finding problems. But in general, the fines for these problems are very low. In general, they're not really shut down. The Skin Cancer Charity are in the process of undergoing a freedom of information request, looking at how many complaints have been put forward, under 18-year-olds being able to access sunbed shops. And actually, it's very, very low. So suggesting that the vast majority of places are, essentially getting away with allowing under 18-year-olds to get in.
And as you said, there is a demand that children seem to be interested in doing this stuff. So maybe now's a good time to look at the elephant in the room, which I guess is social media. My question should be, why are children suddenly so interested when we thought we got the message across and people were wearing hats, not going out in the sun, being careful, etc.? All that seems to have gone. Why?
You're absolutely right. Social media is a huge challenge to overcome because misinformation is rife on not just UV safety, but health in general. So common, myths we see include things like a tan is healthy, and people say a tan is attractive, but actually we know a tan is your skin's demonstration of injury. We don't go around showing off our broken leg proudly, but we do for some reason with a tan. And other things, people talk about, having, sunscreen in their makeup and talk about like that's protective, but actually sunscreen in makeup doesn't offer anywhere near the amount of protection we need, because we'd need to put on gallons of the stuff to actually gain the sun protection factor described on the makeup we're using. So SPF in makeup can largely be disregarded. Other things that are common in social media is this conception that we don't need to reapply sunscreen. So for the vast majority of sunscreens on the market, it doesn't do much after between around 2 and 4 hours. So if you put your sunscreen on in the morning, 4 hours later, it's pretty much doing nothing.
Sunscreen, is there any point in anything less than some protection factor 50?
It's a good question. Yes, is the short answer. I mean, SPF 30 or above is perfect. And I often say to people, there's not much point using under a factor 30, because apart from anything else, if you're putting it on, you might as well do it properly. And the difference between factor 30 and factor 50 is not huge. So if you only have a factor 30, don't worry about it. However, if you have both available, go for the factor 50.
Okay. I've got a 16-year-old son, and he... he's into social media, et cetera, et cetera. And he has started looking at loads of stuff online about how you look, do your hair and skin, skin regimes and all kinds of stuff. And because I knew I was going to be talking to you, I asked him, I said, when you look at this sort of stuff, do you take any note or try and figure out who it is that is giving you this information? Now, He's slightly different, because when people come on this show, I often ask them what their qualifications are, etc. And also his mum, my wife, is a cancer research scientist. So he's not, from that point of view, he's not a normal kid. And he said, well, actually, I do look. And I look to see if they're a doctor or what have you. And then I said, well, do you know if dermatologist is a protected title? Actually, he understood the question. Like he didn't say something like, oh, Dad, shut up, don't be so stupid. But he knew what I was getting at. So tell me, in the UK and elsewhere, is dermatologist a protected title? So if someone on social media says, yeah, I'm a dermatologist, do what I say as far as your skin's concerned, does that have any standing?
So it's a good question. And I think, well, consultant dermatologist is a protected title. So to become a consultant dermatologist, you need to have been recognised by the General Medical Council, which is our doctor governing body.
Yeah.
So
well, you've got to be an MD to start off with, haven't you?
Well, you've got to be a doctor, yeah. A medical doctor. So MD is more of the sort of American general qualification.
Okay.
In the UK, we have things like MBCHB or MBBS usually. So you do your 5 or 6 years of medical school, and then you typically do anywhere between 5 or 6 years of general medical training. And then you go on to do about approximately 4 or plus years of dermatology specific training. So it's a long process. Now, so that's what it takes to become a consultant dermatologist. The whole protected title issue is obviously a bit tricky. I think, first of all, I do not think you need to be a consultant dermatologist to spread positive and correct sun safety information. So I certainly don't think, just because someone's not a consultant dermatologist, it doesn't mean you don't listen to them, but obviously there's lots of mix in between that. There's only around 600 consultant dermatologists in the UK, and the vast majority of them are not on social media. Mm-hmm. So I think yes, of course, it's always important to check your sources, and of course there are lots of people out there who are spreading misinformation. Sometimes they know they're doing it, and sometimes they don't know they're doing it. In general, I like to think that doctors are not doing that. But dermatologist in itself is not a protected title. So you might see some people saying that they are skin specialists, skin experts, that sort of thing, and they may well be not a doctor at all.
So what would you suggest to teenagers listening to this if they're kind of scrolling through TikTok, picking up advice about tanning or skin in general? What do you suggest they do when they're kind of looking at this? Maybe the suggestion is not to look at this stuff. I don't know, but we've got to live in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to live in the real world. I think the big thing is that all these people need to come together and speak to their schools about participating in Expose the Glow. Expose the Glow is this new secondary skills initiative that schools can sign up to. So if you're a parent or if you are a secondary school pupil, you can encourage your school to sign up. The idea is that you do this together with your peers, and it's like an interactive digital classroom environment where you work together through all these tanning trends that we've discussed today and more, and you can discuss whether they're a myth, truth, or whether you're unsure. And you're absolutely right. I think, people are going to look at social media, whether we like it or not. Anyone who doesn't think that is unfortunately living in a fantasy world. We're in the situation and we now have to deal with it. I think we have really good, qualification now with tools like Expose the Glow to protect our children and reduce their lifelong risk of skin cancer. So if you are a teenager, if you're not sure what to believe, encourage your school to sign up to Expose the Glow, and really just remember that any time you see someone's skin changing colour, that is damage.
Okay. How can schools sign up to this Expose the Glow programme?
Mm-hmm. So it's very easy. You sign up via expositheglow.co.uk, and this takes you then to this landing area. This should all be done by the school itself rather than individuals. And this will then allow you to participate in this interactive digital classroom environment.
Okay. Is it free?
It is free, absolutely, of course. So the Skin Cancer Charity have put so much work into making this a free resource because we feel so passionately that this should be free, and we can really improve the nation's public health.
Okay, so any teachers who are interested in this stuff, parents or children, need to kind of get schools to sign up for this, Expose the Glow?
Expose the Glow.
Okay, excellent. One final question, which you kind of touched on, and this is a big question. And if people are, wanting to get to grips with this public health issue, do you think it's worth government trying to control social media in some way? Because, this is a huge question, and this isn't just about skincare and being concerned about the sun, because all the time I see things on social media that irritate the hell out of me. And I just get worried about my children because people are peddling just rubbish. Do we just have to hold our hands up in the air and go, oh, we can't do anything about it? Or is it worth trying to do something? And if so, what?
So it's a great question. I think it's so timely and important. Is it worth the government controlling social media? I don't think so, because I think, you know, we should be proud to be in a kind of democratic, free country that we're not controlled by the state. But I think the problem is not so much who's controlling social media, it's what we're putting on it. You know, I think the problem is not necessarily the government, it's what we are saying. So if we can educate people, if we can show people that actually this is what's true, this is what's important, then, you know, that this is the plan. And I think that we can still maintain a democratic state, we can still be free, but we just need to get more educated, we need to increase our health literacy, and we need to be more sun safe.
Okay, good answer. I like that. Right, the next question is just about me, really. I'm being a little bit selfish. It's kind of a sunny day outside, but it's quite chilly. I mean, it's like 10 or 11 degrees centigrade. A bit later today, I'm going to go down the allotment to do some watering. Should I be putting any sun cream on?
So I say to absolutely everyone, okay, think about every single time you go outside in your life. Think about every time you nip out to the car, nip out to the shop for some milk, just nip out even to go for a walk or take your dog out. Every single time, this adds up. Your skin has a phenomenal memory, and every single time it gets a little bit of damage, it remembers. That is all going to contribute to your risk of skin cancer later in life. Now, you might not see anything the next day. You might not see anything the next week or even the next year. But 10 years, 20 years, 30 years later, you are going to see the consequences. For some people, it's going to be sooner. Some people, it's going to be later. Not everyone who gets exposed to the sun regularly or gets lots of excess UV exposure is going to get skin cancer. But everyone who is exposed to lots of UV exposure is going to get wrinkly and look older than the people who are not protecting their skin. Okay. So I advise absolutely everyone on a daily basis, put on your sunscreen, have your sunscreen next to your toothbrush. Think of something you do every single morning that you're not going to forget it. And put some in your bag, in your pocket, in your car, so it's always handy and you can just reapply it throughout the day.
Okay. I suspect that is very good advice. And I have to say, I do hear that from my wife as well. So
be sensible.
Yes. Okay. Right. Final thing. Just give the name of the program, the website that people can go to if they want to get this into their schools.
So I want everyone to go to exposetheglow.co.uk, especially if you're a secondary school, and if you're the parent of someone in secondary school, you can encourage your school to sign up. This is done via skin.org. So SKCIN is the charity, but the website to register is exposetheglow.co.uk.
Excellent. Amy, Dr. Perkins, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat. This is important stuff. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Good, The next topic is microplastics. And I asked as a first question to Alexander Nolt of Guppy Friend, how small does a piece of plastic have to be before it's considered a microplastic?
I mean, we talk about, per definition, particles that are smaller than 5 millimeters, and we differentiate between primary microplastic and secondary microplastic. Primary microplastic, there's type A, which is already produced smaller than 5 millimeters, and type B would be microplastic that is breaking off bigger particles such as car tires or textiles.
Okay. So actually, that leads nicely onto my next thought that I wanted to just quickly cover. Where's all this stuff coming from?
I mean, there are tons of solutions, but we have to think beyond packaging and bottle. Yeah, microplastic. I mean, today's microplastic is tomorrow's nanoplastic. Yeah, and which also means that yesterday's microplastic is today's nanoplastic. Yeah, because these two things, and
it
you mentioned that it's quite popular these days. When we started back a decade ago, nobody knew anything about microplastic. We even got threatened to be sued by textile associations if we claim that their textiles have a problem. But the sources are manifold. Yeah, we have lots of plastic that surrounds us. There are many, many sources, from household dust to the sponges we use in our kitchen, and certainly the textile that we're wearing every day and that we're washing almost every other day.
So how much comes from like the breakdown of larger plastics? You know, because there's massive areas in kind of in the middle of the ocean, big islands, floating islands of plastic bottles and plastic gunk. How much comes from that kind of stuff breaking down?
I mean, most of it that is not visible is underneath the surface because it's breaking down and into smaller and smaller pieces, and it has all the additives and chemicals on it, and it has a tendency in the water, it accumulates all the bacteria, and this is how it gets into the food chain, even into plankton, which is a cornerstone of the marine ecosystem, and then it may come back on our plate.
I'm interested in just sort of going through the different potential sources. Really.
Yeah, depending on the source and who is doing the study, and it's always what you need to know when we talk about microplastic. It's always an estimate from some kind of expert.
It's
really hard to count them, and you always, if you look at these numbers, you always have to be suspicious looking, where are they coming from, who has paid the study, what is the intention of these people, because especially in terms of microplastic and yet not having like really norms and standards how to measure them, or everybody has its own you always have to be critical towards any number that is out there. Talking about like the sources, of course we have the secondary microplastic that breaks down, which comes from building construction, from packaging, from bottles on the one hand side, and the other hand side you have like these where people are mostly not aware of this, like this primary microplastic that is coming from these car tires, that is coming from textiles. And the main culprit here is, depending on who is doing the research, is it always goes between tires and textiles.
Okay. So they're like the two primary as far as we know at the moment. The main source is
people.
So this is just tire wear. Don't even have to be braking and screeching to a halt. Regular tire wear produces this.
Yes, and I mean, people are mostly aware about cosmetics because that was like popular in the media. But that is only 2% maybe, and that's an easy fix because you can easily replace abrasives with sand or nutshells or whatsoever.
So these are microbeads you're talking about.
That's microbeads. There's also, I mean, like this that. Is Mike. This is the problem when we talk about microplastic. We have one name, but it comes in 1,000 different shapes. We talk about 10,000 different chemicals. That is why it's also so hard for. I mean, microplastic are around since some time, but like the European Commission or the World Health Organization, they have mentioned it first time in 2018, respectively 2019. So that's not that long ago. And we still try to find reference models and analyzes how to really tackle it down. And we have done lots of workshops for United Nations Environmental Program. We have been invited as experts from members of parliament here in Britain or the OECD in Paris. It's really hard for them to get to get a hold on this because so many business models depend on it, and we are surrounded by this. And where do we start? So if you take like asbestos, for example, it took us 20 years from analyzing or from realizing that it's bad for our health until it was fully banned. And it looks like that with microplastic, that could be the same. And you're probably fully aware, and though are your listeners, that wherever we look for microplastic, we find it. So it's in the remote mountain areas, in the ice of the Arctic, in the deepest point of the sea.
It is a massive topic, and I'm sure we could talk for hours, but let's home in actually on your expertise,
yes,
which you touched on already, which is actually clothing. The fact we've got microplastics in a lot of clothing. So where do these microplastics come from, and how do they kind of get out of the clothing into our world?
Yeah, I mean, most of the fibers which we use these days are made of plastic. So nylon, acrylic, elastan, polyester. And when we wash, not only when we wash, but also when we use, wear and tear, the tiny fibers break and they go out in the environment, especially when we wash, because you have lots of abrasion in the washing machine, and they can't copy back by the washing machine. They pass the most, well, a lot past the wastewater treatment plants, and once in the water, they go to the food chain. So the problem here, and this is what also showed our survey, is we have a very big problem, and the media refers to it. You already mentioned that as one of the biggest environmental problem of our time, because it's linked to health, because it's linked to biodiversity, because it's linked to the climate change. So that's the problem is huge. Yet nobody knows about it. So if there are only 7 in 10 Brits who have ever heard about it, and they are not fully aware, let alone the consequences, how should we as individual society address a topic? So the first reason, and this is why we started Guppy Friend in the first place as an NGO, we wanted to raise awareness. Because if nobody knows, we can't do anything about it. And then we did lots of testings on 3 different continents with lots of labs and also brands to just get like the data and to understand the scope of the problem. And then at that stage, we said, okay, let's provide easy solutions for people so that they become an expert while using them. So that's kind of a little bit the story.
Okay. So what journey? What did you come up with? So like easy solution number one, that Mike Dilt can do something to stop all
my partner and I, we're doing the first testing we were doing in our own bathroom. And we talk about like tiny little things, but then we did the math and said, okay, we have millions of households and we wash quite frequently. What is it actually doing? And we were sitting in a beer garden back in Berlin and said, okay, we
all
need
the best ideas are fueled by beer, I find.
Yeah, isn't
actually.
It? Isn't it? But the bad thing, the bad part about it is that even in the beer we drink is microplastics. So
don't ruin my beer for me, Alex. Come on.
These days, that's the way it is. So we were sitting there and saying, okay, people keep on asking, hey, we understood the problem, but what can we do? And we said, okay, we are good in coming up with eco solution. Let's come up with this. Let's provide this back. If the politicians won't do anything, the brands or the appliance manufacturer don't do anything, they're just finger pointing at each other. So let's start coming up with these products that in the case of the washing bag, which is our first product, it prevents fibers from breaking, but it also stops, it prevents them from breaking. So the Fraunhofer Institute, which is a well-known institute in Germany, calculated that an average 86% less fibers break. So whatever you wash inside the bag has a longer lifetime. And the bag
so
itself,
you put your plastic clothes in the bag,
put it
and
in
put
the bag,
all that in the washing machine.
And you put that in the washing machine, and the bag doesn't lose fibers itself because it's a monofilament. It's not like a thread. It's rather like a stick.
Yeah.
And it prevents the fibers from breaking. So what you wash inside the bag has a longer lifetime. And those fibers that do break, they hold back reliably.
So it's not that the bag has tiny little holes that the fibers can't get out. It's just that it prevents the fibers from breaking in the first place.
No, both things, Mike. So they stop the fibers from breaking, and those that do break, and that is the challenging here from a technical perspective, because the tiny openings, and we talk about like 250 threads on 1 centimeter. So you have to get like the water and detergent needs to go inside the bag. And yet at the same time, the fibers that do break,
That was going to be my question. If the holes are small enough to stop the fibers getting out, how does the water and the soap get in?
No, but it gets in, soap and water. And when a fiber breaks, it has a certain size because it needs to have like leverage where it's breaking. And so it captures them reliable. And that's the best thing what we can do.
Do we end up with a bag full of fibers? What do you do with that?
I mean, full of fibers. First of all, if 86% don't break on average, it's always only a tiny.
Less
and we talk about microplastics. So after a couple of washes, you get, and this is the challenge for us also to explain people that even such a little amount has such a destructive impact on our health and the environment. So that is a challenge from our communication side. But you it gathers in the upper corners, and you take them out and put them in the trash or in some kind of vessel, and then you dispose them.
So that putting them in the trash so it goes to landfill is less bad than going into the sea via the wastewater.
It is less saying that is it. Yes, if you have like in a container and it's centralized. However, there is hardly any landfill these days. Even in Great Britain, it's 10-15%, and due to regulation and taxes, that is decreasing. But even if it goes to landfill, first of all, fibers don't break, and then those that do break, if you put them like centralized in some kind of vessel. Yeah. And put them in the trash.
This sounds like a good plan. However, let me just take advantage of me speaking to an expert just now. Maybe you can advise me on this. I have been looking at ways to maybe get a filter in my kitchen for all sorts, from the water, for the drinking water, for all sorts of things. But all the filters that talk about the size of the filter, they kind of shy away from the problem of microplastics, and they don't really mention it. I suspect because a lot of the filters available commercially aren't much good for microfilters. So should I boil all the water so the microfilters kind of clump together in one big lump, and then maybe I can filter them? What should I do about drinking water?
I mean, I can talk so much about other filter technologies and what they talk about or what they not talk about. But your observation is kind of right. Appliance manufacturer and everybody is avoiding the topic as much as they can before somebody makes them accountable for something. And that is also something that we have to deal with. When I was here talking to the members of parliament, they invited like people from water infrastructure, from textile brands, from NGOs, so from very different from solution providers. And I was thinking we're all shooting towards the same goal. Well, that wasn't the case. Everybody had his own agenda and was asking something else to the politicians. Yeah. So that's when I understood, hey, wait a second, this is not how I want to spend my time. We should rather focus on coming up with these easy solutions that everybody can easily implement into their daily routines. And by using these tools, they understand more about the sources. They look into their care label, what's made out of plastic, what isn't. They question why the household trash, what's the ratio of plastic here, and how do I can filter it out? Because filtering out is not, it's not a rocket science. And we have now extended this because we say, hey, we need the solution for end customers to enable them to explain it and have a tool that also works as a daily reminder, as something you can talk about on the one hand side. On the other hand side, we have lots of brands who have lots of microplastic. Let's say football. We have like in Germany, we started and we now have the first Premier League clubs. They wash a lot on the one hand side. So they can't put it all in the bag. So we have like specially designed external washing machine filters for them on the one hand side. On the other hand side, they have these artificial surf pitches. You have the artificial grass, you have the
Of
infill
course, yeah,
material.
artificial grass. That must make so much microplastic.
It's incredible. And again, there's a study saying it's almost 3,000 kilos per year and pitch. So that's a lot. You have the
How
fine
much of that
material.
gets inhaled by professional footballers?
I mean, this
That's great
is.
to think.
I mean, this is what's happening, and there's a Netflix series which I can recommend. It just came out. I mean, it's a Netflix series, yeah. But it still shows a very interesting aspect. If you get like the microplastic and the toxins out of your immediate environment, what is it doing in terms of for your health? And in that case of the documentary, there are couples who want to conceive, and they don't succeed, and by taking out these fibers and the toxins out of their daily surrounding, they a lot of things are happening in a good way. So if you don't, whatever you do, and I totally understand that the topic can be overwhelming sometimes for why should I do something? So we have to watch out that it's not like there is nothing that we can do. It's way too big, the whole problem. So we have to break it down, and don't rely on the politicians. Understand that microplastic is a team sport, but every individual needs to do its part in this. And it's a tiny step that you can do. And once you do that and see these microplastic sources and see the results, then it's even fun.
Yeah, Alex, this is a massive topic and an alarming topic. I might have to invite you back for your own special series on the show, mini series, because we've hardly scratched the surface here. But if people are listening and think, right, I would like to go out and find a little bit more for myself and find out a bit more about this kind of washing such that I pollute less myself, can you please point people to a good couple of sources of information?
I mean, certainly we provide like the washing guides, what you can do, easy fixes that less plastic leaves your washing machine. I mean, everybody knows how to wash wool and silk, but nobody knows how to wash synthetics, which is kind of weird because that's the dominant fiber that we have out there. And we also have like some tips how to avoid a microplastic in general. That's on guppyfriend.com. But if you Google it, then there's a Netflix doku, and that would be the first step. Make yourself an expert on it. Consume some information. Be critical about what you're reading and where it's coming from. But that's the first step. And learn about the sources, and then apply these washing rules one by one. And then thirdly, just use the solution that are out there. Just do it.
Alex, this is an important topic. So many thanks for taking the time to kind of enlighten me and the rest of us. So thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Amy Perkins. She's a consultant dermatologist and she's lead ambassador for the Skin Charity. She was talking about the damage that the sun can do to our skin. And then Alexander Nolte. He is with Guppy Friend, and he was talking all about microplastics and one way, several ways that we can do our bit to try and reduce the amount of microplastics going into the environment. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.